of the others Bill mentioned this morning about throwing out those innocent that had a reason for responding. One thing I clearly did in those first two studies also indicated in there what the accuracies were if you included them. That wasn't in that third report, and that was something I always exalted. I'm not sure how much of that I wrote. The second part that I was going to look at was the issue of the examiner's bias. And my very preliminary, on the surface look at it was there didn't seem to be any difference. It didn't seem to be having an effect. And at that time, we had the Scientific Advisory Committee, which I'm sure you've heard of, and the individuals that were involved in that. And we had a meeting, and I presented this information to them, and they said, well, you know, what about if you look at it, break it down, innocent, guilty, racial issues, those sorts of things. I had started to do that. I had started to find some results. There was, what I can recall, there was a difference in for, I think it was for guilty subjects, the examiner's opinion had more influence on it than it did for the innocent. But again, I had just started doing these analyses. I was just starting to get them out when I left.
You and I spoke on the phone about this at some length. And this is not the study that was data collected by a whole bunch of different people who are trainees. Is that correct? You told me about some preliminary data that was collected by trainees at polygraph school.
Oh, you're talking about demographic studies.
Which those,
yeah,
about
that's
now.
The demographic studies are a different set of data.
Thank you.
So there's probably a number of reasons that the third study wasn't put out. Some of it probably has to do with some of the stuff I was going to find in it. Some of it has to do with just what was the personal issues and things that made me at the time. I am not the person that didn't get it out, so I really can't answer the question.
So when you say that you use race as a factor, could you explain that?
What I was going to go back and do is look at examiner race, examinee race, and influences of the examiner's opinion of their guilt or innocence on the actual decision of guilt or innocence.
How
large
are your cells for examiners? How many African Americans would you say you had?
Couldn't even tell you. At this point in time, that was so I couldn't even tell you.
More than two or three, or less?
Yeah, I would say more than two or three. I think there probably was enough to have looked at today. So that was, you know, interesting.
Do we know where that data are now?
Were there discussions when you were on those tests and how this project might be proceeding?
When I left, the atmosphere at the Institute was to try to discredit me with whatever they could. And they tried to use the third test study to do that. So,
can you suggest, can you help us understand the motivation for that?
For trying to discredit me?
Yeah. And for not, then therefore for not pursuing the study, which sounded more.
I think it's probably twofold. And this is only my position. Okay? I mean, it was a year before I was ever officially even given any indication of why I was, my security clearance was taken away. It was twofold. One, I believe I was becoming influential in the with the people who kind of got John Elliff was listening to what I had to say.
And he was?
John Elliff at the time was some assistant deputy undersecretary thingy person that was over the institute. I never was good with keeping titles.
That's how we would describe.
But he was he was, my understanding, you know, kind of a big wig at the Pentagon that was directly above what was going on at the institute. I was voicing my opinions about, I didn't think the screening should be being done.
Which screening?
Any screening.
Any screening.
You didn't think polygraphs should be used for screening?
No. I have documents in places that I made statements that if they were going to insist on doing screening, that they should probably shut the programs down, train people who knew what they were doing, and start all over.
Was there a particular implementation of screening that led you to make such statements?
It just had to do with all of the problems that are inherent with this entire field. As far as, you know, you've heard people talk about they're still using antiquated equipment. Well, it's worse than that. They're not just using antiquated equipment. They're not using the antiquated equipment right. You know, I mean, simple things like deciding to use conductance or resistance, still using metal electrodes, not using electrode paste, not having an understanding of what the equipment is doing so that they're filtering out the very signals that they're trying to use to score. So, I mean, you have the whole, and the computerized stuff is no better. Bruce White, I spent hours trying to get Bruce White to explain to me what his filters were doing and how his amplifiers were built. And I mean, he couldn't even understand the concept of resistance and conductance being an issue.
Bruce White is?
Bruce White's the manufacturer of Axicon.
Do we, just for the record, do we know what Axicon actually uses? Because there's been some issue.
At this point, it's still not clear. But the best guess is it's a resistance measure, not a conductance measure.
Still.
Yeah.
And we're reading papers.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but we do know it's nonlinear.
Yeah.
I mean, people have done studies and shown that the amplifiers are not linear.
It's just like, I mean, I would try to teach them things in physiology. You know, you have an electrodural response. Hey, you're insisting on measuring resistance. Well, the amplitude of that response is going to depend on your baseline, where you start out from. So you get a big response. Well, gee, let's center it back down and make believe it didn't happen and ask another question. You know? And I would teach these things, and they would go back into the labs, and the instructors would say, forget about what they're teaching you. This is how we're going to do it.
So when I read a paper, as I did last night, that talks about resistance and being skin resistance and being infected, I should take that literally.
Yes. Yeah, they're measuring resistance. And you know, one of the things is I almost got them converted to conductance, but if you know about the nonlinear transformation, when you measure conductance, your amplitudes are going to be a whole lot smaller. Well, the bumps weren't big enough for them to count, so they want the bigger bumps where the pen goes off the screen and they have to recenter. But it was just this constant, the cardio channel, the same thing. They have no clue what they're measuring with the cardio channel. And they talk about the APL not knowing, well, gee, they didn't know the physiology. Well, that's not true. I was in on the ground floor when APL started their algorithm. I spent hours with Dale Olson trying to explain to him about the physiology, about, you know, the amplitude of that cardio response. You can't just take that. It depends on the relationship between the cuff pressure and the mean arterial pressure. You know, and I'm sorry, my frustration's returning. as much as, you know, I tried to teach these things, they didn't want to change. And, you know, it's like even with developing the test, coming up with standardized procedures on how to administer and how to do it, I would train the people doing the research and go back the next week and they're doing it different. They want to do what they wanted to do, how they wanted to do it, you know. Sometimes it would be similar to what you asked them to do. Sometimes it wouldn't be. You know, of course, there were certain parameters that they couldn't get outside of. I'd bring them back, you know, 6 months later, do another study, and you'd have to retrain them all. And, it was just this constant... Anyway, it's built the manual, the instruction manual. This is how tests is to be conducted. We'll get into the issue of cost design and research in a minute. John Schwartz, and he rewrote the manual. but this isn't how it was. Well, we've never done it that way before. But this is the way it was done in the research. This is how it was standardized.
When you attempted to standardize it in the research, did the research implement the standardized method pretty well?
I would have to say no. I cannot be confident that that's the case.
Because
of the problems that
because
I was just talking
examiners
about. They were entrenched in their habits. They didn't want to listen to the issues and the problems. And I can't be confident that the standardized procedures that were set out were actually implemented that way. So I think we started out with why was I asked saying that I thought it, you know, they shouldn't be doing screening. I mean, I don't think they should be doing screening at all. Because, everybody knows about the base rate issue and those types of things. Field research, I don't care what anybody says, field research is impossible. I mean, even in a simple arena of the single issue criminal test, you look at the field research, what is omitted? It doesn't matter whether you're getting it with confessions or getting it with corroborating evidence, the tests that are omitted from the study is going to be the guilty person that was run innocent. You're not ever going to confess. Or the innocent person that was run guilty. You know, some of them will get in, but you're going to have a systematic bias in what's omitted. Can't get around that. And that's in a situation where you know something happened. How are you ever going to do that in a situation where you don't even know if anything has gone on? There's no way to establish ground truth. Field studies are next to, in my opinion, useless.
Just for the sake of discussion, in medicine, which is an area in which I do my applied work, we do use a lot of things without equivalent ground truth. We do use diagnostic tests and screening tests where we have no gold standard. And then when we start to get up looking pretty good, there's sort of a cycle where you can go wrong or you can gradually hone in on something. But is there a reason why we shouldn't do that here?
You have some type of outcome on which to hang your hat. The person died.
So we can watch.
You can pretty much bet that whatever you did didn't work. So you have some outcome to eventually say, okay, this is working or this isn't working. In this type of situation, you don't have that type of definitive outcome in 99.9% of the cases. You know, someday you have a pains and you know what the outcome was. But other than that, you don't have those outcomes to be able to collect that type of information.
Did you see utility imaging and not validity?
The technique can be very useful in getting people to tell you information. I would definitely agree with that. The whole process can be very useful in getting people to tell you information.
Did the transition from laboratory tests of the TES to the field screening occur while you were at that point?
Yes, if I'm understanding your question, they did implement using TES in the field while I was there.
So the timing was about when? 1990?
Studies were run in 93-94 time frame.
And so that was about time when they were implementing the screening program.
Yeah. And again,
with the instrument you were testing,
I was involved in trying to go out to the agencies and training the examiners, and what our intention was to train a small group of examiners that could then train, you know, and all of the agency examiners came in to be trained in the new format. But I didn't always recognize what was being taught when I would go around and watch. So,
on the one hand, you were training the examiners to do screening, but you didn't believe in it really. It was state, so upstairs.
I went into the institute knowing very little about lie detection. You know, it took a while to figure out what was going on and understand all of the concepts. But yeah, I got to the point where I don't believe this screen makes any sense at all.
But that puts you obviously in an anomalous position with respect to the people you were working with. That was the level in which they could perceive that there was a difference.
Very difficult.
Do you think that any of the difficulty had to do with the specifics of that third research project?
I really can't answer that. I don't know. John was pissed at me because I was lauding him not to be the director of the institute. So how much of it was personal, how much of it had to do with the fact that I was becoming influential, people at Pentagon were listening to what I had to say, I don't know. I can't tease that out.
So can I come back to the question earlier? Were there discussions at that time about that research being at least being taken over? Was there any sort of transition effort when you left to move that research to someone else?
Well, what you got to realize is that I left in 5 minutes. On a Friday afternoon, I was called in and said, "Your security clearance has been lifted. Leave the building." Okay? So, in that sense, no, there was no transition. We had done another study, not specifically on counterintelligence, but using the format and using it in a drug application. So there was another study that was done. And basically it was a study to help generalize the format itself.
So, she literally said, you know, there's a pattern here, so disturbing allegations, to say the least. In the case of what Charles was saying this morning, he talked about stuff becoming classified and effectively suppressed. That's the implication. And then not having to do it sitting in his office learning human function analysis and microjobs, and could use it as time. And you're implying that nothing that you know of was actually classified. You lost your security clearance, and so...
Well, the description of the job was to have a security clearance, so once they found a way to lift my clearance...
So did you... Because you remained in the employee of Dodd-Mine?
Technically, I was still employed. I like to think of it as being under house arrest. Since I was being paid, I was required to be in my house during working hours.
For how long?
A year. And it was a year before I was ever even given any information whatsoever about why the action had been taken.
And are you free to share that information with me?
I can. I don't think that it's relevant to what you're asking.
Okay, then don't.
I mean, I'm not here to grind that axe. So if you think it's relevant, I certainly can do it.
Can I just follow up a little bit?
This was Jim's point too, so it might be related.
So, we have two former researchers, late 80s, early to mid 90s, from Dodd-Mine. Does this happen to anybody else?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and I haven't even given y'all the information about the demographic studies.
No, I don't mean that. I meant, are there other researchers who either all of a sudden
Barbara Carlton had done some research with cardiovascular stuff. Bill Yankee took her all her data and decided he was going to reanalyze it. She ended up leaving.
Any others? How long did you guys overlap?
Just a year.
Barbara was there about the same time.
Barbara started the same time I did.
They had a better tolerance for it. I left before they pulled my security clearance.
Can I understand? It relates to the word in data.
Data are not classified.
So, in principle, the data from that study, if they existed, would not be restricted on the basis of clearance.
Right.
The data are not classified as of your last knowledge.
As of my last knowledge, the data were not classified.
Why? Is that a mistake?
They forget.
Well, Bill Yankee had tried to. Bill Yankee really did try to leave things open. He really did try the best he knew to make it a scientific endeavor. However, if you wrote something that Bill Yankee disagreed with, it did not get in the report.
Could we just go sideways a little bit? Could you tell us a little bit about cardiovascular study?
I don't remember exactly what she did. I think she worked with Drew Richardson on it. That's the one. But she did a study, and I believe it was cardiovascular stuff. And it was Barbara's stuff, and I don't know honestly whether they didn't like the results or what was going on. But I know Bill Yankee took the data from her, and he decided he was going to have it reanalyzed. I don't know that it was ever done or what was ever done.
You don't know what the issue was?
No, not now. Not at
all. But was Drew Richardson then working for Dodd-Vine?
I think it was part of the research that Drew did.
Drew
never worked for Dodd-Vine.
Okay.
Drew was there for the school for about 14 weeks and went through the school. And then he was trying to collaborate with us on research, and I think it was Barbara that he was working with. And I think it was some of that research that got told.
Sheila, while it's clearly part of a record somewhere, I do not remember who the advisory committee was that you
made. Steve Porges.
Ed
Hacken, Bill Iacono, Chris Patrick, John Fury. I think that was it.
That was after Monday.
Yeah, I think that was it.
Porges, Iacono, Patrick.
Captain. And Fury. Yeah, and they had a shit fit when my clearance was pulled and they got fired.
Was Raskin on the
No, Raskin was not on the
So that was an advisory committee for the studies or for
yeah.
the
I ran everything I did on those studies, I ran through Ed Captain and
Okay.
And they were given updates on the results and stuff.
And that was one of the things that I had worked for when I was there and argued that they needed was external oversight. So actually, I saw that as a real positive thing that happened after I left. Then it suddenly it disappeared.
There are the demographic studies. When I first got there, what I did, they have the classes come through, and I kept data on the classes, and I ran a ton of demographic. Been looking at age, race, socioeconomic, a whole bunch of different things. I wrote up a fairly large report on the results. There was some significant findings. One of the significant findings had to do with, I believe it was examinee's race. Because I looked at examiner and examinee variables. I believe that's the one that Gordon presented to a group at one point, and the next day Bill Yankee yanked it. Ask for all the copies to have. So
that was observational data based on
that was
all the trainees coming
through. Right, the trainees come through in their lab. Every day they have a lab in which they do a pre-test, they do a test, they have our outcome.
You get from the base coming over?
During that point in time we were using trainees, yeah. And we looked at issues like sleep and all sorts of different things.
So you would have a fair bit of minority representation in the testees, but not necessarily in the
Not
testers.
A huge representation, but we did have quite a few African-American.
Any Mexican-American?
I can honestly tell you off the top.
Now?
Probably some Hispanics.
Yeah.
But I wrote up a very large report on all of this demographic stuff. And decided that it really wasn't legitimate because it was trainings. So. result.
Were they all using the same techniques, or were they using different techniques in
the... Well, what I was doing was tracking them as they were going to school, and they were learning different techniques as they were going to school. So it would have been a conglomeration of the different techniques.
Actually, they're probably better than everyone else. Yeah. They didn't
get killed. And where does that end up?
You're asking me.
Where were they all asking you?
In the Department of Defense folders. You could get a hold of it, but I don't want to have it.
You threw the FBI computer.
I also believe I did some racial stuff on the test studies. I presented and I submitted an abstract to the Department of Science for their FedNet5 convention. The abstract exists somewhere. I was supposed to go up and give a paper on it. I got sick. John Schwartz was supposed to do it. He came back and reported. He just didn't have time to present that paper. So,
is there a proceeding to that conference if the abstract published?
I would think the abstract would be published.
This is the first test study. The initial three studies.
It was in 95. My best recollection, it would have been on the test studies.
And again, the test studies are the three studies.
Yes.
We have seen an abstract. I don't remember what journal. You know, there was something about the test studies that, you know, summarized in just a few paragraphs. And it had some data from the three test studies, but I don't remember including any demographic data.
No, it wouldn't have been. That would have been something else I could
look at. Who else had kind of working investigatory kind of in scientific sense access to those data? Were there any collaborators?
Not really. Not that we're working on any data analysis or anything like that. I mean, the entire DOD collaborated in getting the research done and sending the examiners and support people and things like that.
Anybody from outside?
No. Not on the test.
On the demographics, I'm sorry.
Okay, well, again, the original demographics was done on the students. So that was just an in-house thing. And the other one, the 95 one, would have been stuff that I pulled out of the test studies.
Were you, well, I guess it's a question about Charles and to you, and you may have different answers because of the time you were there, and maybe Eddie can help too. It's our understanding that the polygraph research was consolidated and brought entirely, at least government research, within the umbrella of DOTPI. But that prior to some point, other agencies did their own research. What year was that?
93.
Well, when I was still there in 95, which agencies are you referring to?
Other federal agencies.
When I was there up until August 3rd of 1995, I know CIA was still doing their own research. And I know NSA was doing their own research. Other than that, I can't tell you.
Well, my question wasn't so much for who might have continued to do research, but we're parallel research efforts in other agencies. Were you routinely kind of aware of those, just the conferences or through contact, et cetera, Charlie?
Yeah, well, we were aware of them. Sometimes. I mean, yeah, some things happen when we weren't aware of them. There was a research program at FBI. John Podlesny ran a lab at FBI for many years, went away to a convention, came back, and his lab was gone, literally. They packed it up and moved everything out. In 96. I ended up with his equipment. They were going to salvage it, and he calls me up and says if I could come up with enough money to take the freight, they could donate it to Boise State University. So I ended up with his lab equipment. And I think that was a direct result of the fact that he was very negative about screening at FBI. and said things about it. And you know, that what happened to him is his lab just disappeared. I haven't talked to John in a number of years. I he ended up in a completely different part of FBI on the polygraph run.
And very frequently, research was jammed down our throats. We had no choice about what the design was or how it was going to be run or anything. You know, it's like, oh, here, NSA wants this run, and they're giving you some money and whatever, and this is what you're going to do. I fought tooth and nail, the Yankee did also, to try to stop the APL stuff disaster. Which I see didn't work.
Could you give us a sense of the institutional culture that you, in your opinion, of course. Obviously, it's in the agency's interest not to have a bad test. So why, I'm having a hard time explaining to myself why they would vary data, why they would not want you to go off in new directions to create a better test, because it's in their interest. Got the best screening device available.
Well, I think some of it hits what Charles said earlier, is that you will validate these things. Not, let's find out what works, but you're going to validate these things. I mean, that's part of it. I think...
Why? I guess I'm... Isn't it in the interest of...
They already know it works. They don't need it tested. They already know it works. And that is the main problem with mentality in the system. They already know it works. They don't. They didn't care what we had to say. They didn't care what we wanted to do. They knew it worked. You know, it was like computerizing the polygraph. They didn't care whether it was accurate. They wanted something that they could take to Congress and say, oh, look, we're modern. We're up to date. We're computerized. I don't know how many questions I had with polygraph examiners over the computerization and what we were doing and why we were doing it. They know it works. They just wanted something that they could present to Congress to say, see, it works. But that's my opinion.
I agree with that totally. You know, when you know truth, and the truth is with a capital T, you don't need anything else. And you know, talking about institutional climate, that's the climate. You know, and you see that, we see references to that, not only in this area, but other areas. Look at the history of DNA, for example. For many years, FBI said, we're the only ones who can do DNA. Nobody else is smart enough to do it. We're the only ones. And it's the same thing in polygraph. It's an institutional culture of arrogance that says, we know the truth. There isn't any other way of doing it. If we didn't do it, then it isn't right. And you'd be running into that all the time.
I do want to temper that. There are some individuals that were in some of those agencies that I dealt with that really did care.
Oh, I agree. I agree with that, but you asked about
the
culture.
The general culture.
Sheila, if you could step back, given the other discussion you've heard today, given the view that you expressed that screening shouldn't have been implemented when it was, what kind of studies would you now find convincing?
Not
of this test, but of any test, that would allow you to, and done by whom, that would let you be convinced that it was a useful thing?
As Bill Iacono pointed out, the autonomic nervous systems are just too easily manipulated. I think anything based on that is going to be fraught with problems. There's just no way to get around it. If some of this brain stuff works out, maybe. The thing I think you need to pay attention to is all of the brain stuff that you're being presented have very narrow parameters at this point of how they can be used. It has to be a guilty knowledge where you already know the information type of thing. If that can be broadened, and what I would caution is as you come up with these new techniques, just get away from what's already been done. Forget about trying to use the questions. You know, sometimes I heard they had the brain stuff going on and I was hearing questions about, well, how would this relate to these questions? You've got to step outside of the formats that have already been used and come up with totally different ways of getting at it. You don't want to take the new technology and try to force it into the old questioning techniques. It won't work. So maybe some of the brain stuff, as it gets more sophisticated, might do something.
On the other hand, you said earlier that you did think that these tests got people provided information.
It gets people to provide
information. So how would you weigh the value of getting from using the test to get people to provide information, even if the test itself is flawed in all the ways that you described?
You know, that as someone else, that's an administrative decision. How much money do you want to spend testing thousands and thousands of people to get a little bit of you and Nadi information on 100? For me, that's an executive administrative decision.
Well, another issue is the deterrence effect. And there have been, we're told that
no studies
to
right.
show
that there's...
But there are some...
I had designed one, by the way, which I was hitting right around.
Okay, there are surveys that are administered alongside polygraphs, which one of the questions they ask people is, do you consider this a deterrent? And they get high percentages of yes, which is hardly surprising.
Which is usually the innocent people that wouldn't probably be doing it anyway.
And on the other hand, there's also no guarantee that how they're answering that question is truthful. So even if I were a guilty person, I might say that it deters me. So can you tell us a little bit about the study in Linda?
No. One of the studies that I had set up before I left, and I don't know what happened. I may have some of it on this.
Behind a couple copy machines.
Well, see, it's in WordPerfect, and my WordPerfect crashed before I came down here. I was trying to print out a bunch of stuff, and my WordPerfect crashed, and I can't get at my file. I had come up with a design to try to get at that issue of deterrence. At this point, I don't remember exactly what it was. But we were going to do something with an employment agency and have people come in, but I really don't remember the parameters on it. I had designed it, and that was one of the next studies that Yankee was going to have me run.
On the basis of your
experience, working at chocolate shop to see if they seal the chocolate.
On the basis of your experience, what do you think it is about the polygraph examination that yields the admission? I mean,
have you ever watched these examiners do an interrogation? Now, Mike Nero teaches post-test interrogation. He does an excellent job at it. And the interrogation is dynamic. And you can get almost anybody to tell you something. Because the way the interrogation is set up, you're given two options. And either option you take, you're in trouble. So part of it's the nature, I mean, it would be neat to see. I'd like to see a study run where they interrogate the innocent. Or even in the field, let them interrogate the innocent. And see how many of those innocent people that were run give you some of the same information when you interrogate them and tell them that they were guilty on it. The interrogation procedure is just phenomenal in and of itself.
And is the interrogation procedure carried out differently depending on what? I'm a polygraph examiner and I believe you're deceptive. Or I'm a polygraph examiner and I believe you're not deceptive. How will that influence?
You don't get interrogated if you come up non-deceptive.
Well, in the pre-employment setting, though, my experience on that many years ago in working back when these things were done in business, a huge matter. I think if people are there, they want to get a job, and I think I kind of talked about some of this morning. I don't disagree with what you had to say about that setting, is that you put them in a tough spot. They want the job. They're told they need to be completely honest. And they talk about a lot of stuff. And some of it's pretty serious stuff. You know, it's always, I thought, remarkable things that people would tell you in that kind of a setting. And I think it's a little bit of a bogus pipeline kind of thing. I don't think the polygraph plays a particular role, except it's a lie detector, and then in a pre-employment setting, it serves that function. and people give up a lot. I have to say I also agree with that kind of on what you had to say about psychopaths. I think psychopaths at that level are not going to give you anything because they're used to lying and they lie well. And then it depends on how well the part. You know, I don't think they have any special ability to be polygraphs, but whether you use the charts in a pre-employment or not. And if you're using relevant and irrelevant in a pre-employment, I don't think you can get much of anything out of that the way it's currently being done, other than its intimidation factor.
And I did not really do anything in a pre-employment arena. Mine was strictly with the espionage sabotage stuff. So I really have not been involved in pre-employment research type of stuff.
Do you think that if you say it's useful in providing information, do you think that if public confidence in validity was significantly undermined, that its value would deteriorate greatly?
I mean, because you go in and you have this, now we even have this computer system, you know, and we all know how accurate computers are. And this computer told me that you lied. Okay? You undermine that belief in it, and I would expect it would be, you know, rather than the person sitting there thinking, well, he really knows that I lied, they're going to, well, you know, he doesn't really know. It's not that accurate, you know. But, so
also,
I think it would impact it.
In looking at the data that Charles presented this morning and some of the other things that we've seen, although there's no strong theory for it, and although it's certainly not as, it's not 100% reliable, there is a statistical correlation between truth-telling and what comes out on the charts, would even that be undermined if belief is part of the physiological correlation that is observed due to the belief that the polygraph works?
I would have to say probably without any data on that. I mean, and I think all of the agencies believe that, otherwise they wouldn't do the acquaintance test to help convince the examiner. I can manipulate my physiological responses. I've sat in class after class and demonstrated it. If my life depended on it, I would not take a polygraph exam because I know how much the examiner can also influence it, whether intentionally or not. And I mean, and Bill Iacono said this morning, and I would reiterate the same thing. I don't think the majority of polygraph examiners out there are any way immoral or intentionally doing anything wrong. I think they just don't understand how their own attitudes and things can influence what they're doing. I don't think we have a bunch of people running around out there trying to screw people.
And you're not talking about the score. In other words, if the APL stuff works as well as the parents as you have to get earlier today, that wouldn't change your opinion.
No. It wouldn't.
Speaking of the APL stuff, you mentioned you used the word the APL disaster, and they said unfortunately it did go forward. Could you pick up on that a little bit?
Well, as I mentioned, I was in on the ground floor when they started working with APL, and I spent a lot of time with Bill Olson trying to get him to understand the physiology and some of what's been done in the past, where there were problems, the things that they needed to take into consideration. And then they went ahead and did what they were doing, and I'm not a sophisticated statistician, so I didn't follow all of the stuff, and I think the Porges report addresses some of the issues as far as the detrending and all of those sorts of things and how it impacts the physiological data. What I did become aware of is that they didn't have any sense of the physiology and how that related to anything that was being measured. I also was aware and was really concerned about the Axicon equipment as far as what was being measured there, what the filters were doing, and Bruce wouldn't tell me. And then they were coming out with reports on the data that they had. Well, look, this is our validity. We're this percent accurate, and trying to convince them that, you know, this has nothing to do with accuracy. You're talking about agreement with these blind examiners. At the time I was there, they did not have any field data that they were working on. It was laboratory collected. No, it was the field data, because they didn't have the ground truth. was just agreement that they were doing. And then when NSA wanted to put more money into it, Bill Yankee and I both, you know, said, hey, this is really a waste of time. You can't be doing this. I was so concerned that at the Atlanta Convention of SPR, I put together a symposium on the different grant systems because I needed to have APL hear from the scientific community what the problems were. They weren't listening to us. So we put the, I put that symposium together. And there was a lot of criticism that came out of the scientific community on what they were doing and how they were doing it. And I don't see that they've done anything different since then.
Time sequencing of this report relative to the disposition of the advisory committee?
That was after. It was after or right about. My clearance was lifted in August of 95. I think the advisory committee was disbanded very shortly thereafter. So it would have been somewhere around the end of 95. Or just went and visited the John Hopkins Laboratory in 96. So that was something that I'm not really sure how that came about. I didn't even know about it until 3 days ago when I found a copy of the report here.
So if you really sort of backed off from a great distance and looked at this, you know, you could look at this as a series of sort of retaliations.
I don't know if this is more for Sheila or for Charles, but could you give me a sense of what the institutional response to the OTA report was? I mean, we're going to anticipate what happens after our report. Do you have a sense of what happened after OTA came out with their report?
Well, that was long before DARPA. OTA came out in 83. DARPA wasn't created until 86. The institutional report was that they felt that Leonard Sachs was highly biased, and NSA wrote their own